Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Samantha Hunt's third novel, Mr. Splitfoot, tracks two women in two times as they march toward a mysterious reckoning. The novel is a contemporary gothic, a subversive ghost story, and a compelling mystery. Hunt's novel about Nikola Tesla, the invention of everything else, was a finalist for the Orange Prize and winner of the Bard Fiction Prize. Her first novel, The Seas, won the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35 Prize. Her work has been performed on This American Life and on NPR's Selected Shorts program. Again, the name of the new novel is Mr. Splitfoot, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Samantha Hunt to The Book Show this week. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
What led you to this particular subject? Has this been something that has been in you for a while?
Parts of it, yes. So the idea of the ghost story was certainly something that started very early on when I was a child, just being fascinated with ghost stories. And so that has always been something that I wanted to attempt, to write a real mystery. Other parts, all the upstate New York history of all the religions that were founded up here, that, when I started writing the book, I was 9 months pregnant with twins and had just moved to a brand new town where I knew no one. And so I started, you know, exploring around upstate New York as best I could. And so two things came out of that. I was frustrated that I was immobile, more or less. I mean, I was just huge with twins. And I felt like, you know, I was going to topple over because it was such a funny shape. And so I was really basically immobile. And so the idea of walking seemed really wonderful to me. And I thought, oh, wow, somebody could walk across the state of New York and that would be such a wonderful trip to take. And you know, had these flights of fantasy about walking all along the entire Erie Canal and down the Hudson River. And so that started right before the book. And then the idea also of all these wonderful religions that are so kind of curiously scattered around New York in a way that I thought, why did this happen? You know, why are spiritualism and Mormonism 15 miles apart, the birthplaces of these religions? And just becoming intrigued with that idea. So visiting Palmyra and visiting Lilydale, the spiritualist community, visiting the Oneida Mansion and thinking about New York's religious history and why this happened. And then getting some sort of bee in my bonnet that I was like, well, you know what? These religions are kind of really good at storytelling in some way. And I thought, I'm going to just make my own religion. And so I set myself the task to build a religion in Mr. Splitfoot. I thought, okay, how do I do that? Well, I'll take everything that I love. So I kind of, you know, just did the kitchen sink model of building my religion. I was like, well, I like mountains. I like geology. I like Carl Sagan. I like rock and roll, you know, and I threw them all together and came up with the Etherists, who are one of the religious groups in this book.
What I find fascinating about that is that it is where faith comes in, because the origin stories, without trying to offend anyone, don't always make sense.
That was absolutely the heart of my interest. When you separate faith out and just look at the stories, I mean, the start of Mormonism, it's magical realism. I mean, it's just kind of wild.
Yeah.
Putting two seeing stones in the bottom of a dark hat and translating a language that Joseph Smith had never heard of that didn't exist. I mean, it's kind of like fireworks for me as a fiction writer. I thought, wow, this is wonderful. I can really invent anything, can I, here? And so that gave me a great sense of freedom of inventing my own religion and seeing then where it would land, what would happen, how it could unravel.
And it takes you even a step further, because as a fiction writer, you can create whatever you want anyway. But if you were to write about standing religions, then that boxes you in. So, but if you create your own, then it's really, you're off to the races.
Exactly. And just that idea of the aspect of these religions as being born in America has always interested me too, and thinking about how to, you know, what is American about my religion? What is American about Mormonism or spiritualism or the Oneida community, and having fun with that idea.
When you came up with the idea, then how do you realize it? Because it seems to me, and I spoke to you right before we went on the air, that this is a difficult book to talk about in many respects, because you don't want to give anything away. And there is that marriage of the magical and the realistic, the ghost story and realism. And were you always aware of that?
Yes. I set myself the task to write a book that could argue two sides. So that's the idea of the split. I wanted to argue both for faith and for belief, and I wanted to argue against it as a way of kind of maybe pointing out the absurdity of why people fight over religion. Who cares what somebody else believes? I don't care what anybody else believes. If their belief makes them happy, that's wonderful. And so I thought, okay, present it as a dual narrative. Present it as both science and religion, and don't disprove one or the other. You know, don't try to take sides, but present the full mystery. Because if I do have an argument with organized religion, it's that I get frustrated at the idea of people trying to own mystery or trying to interpret mystery for others, and find that unnecessary. You know, mystery is unending. Everybody has to deal with mystery. None of us know what death is going to be like. We have that to contend with our entire life. And so how then, you know, to argue both sides and to playfully in some way be able to argue both sides in a book.
But there is that, of course, the idea that we don't know what death is like, but there are many of us, because of a religious background, think we know what it is going to be like and what is going to happen. And we have that belief, so then, of course, we know.
I see, yeah. Well, I guess I don't have that certainty.
Well, nor do I. But,
okay,
but there's certainly many who say, well, this is what's going to happen to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe that's part of my frustration is I don't have a problem existing with unanswered questions. I think that is part of what makes life vivid and fun. And I think that's part of what having conversation and dialogue is about, is saying, let me consider this side. Part of the effort of this book is also to point out how badly we are able to have conversations anymore. You know, it's like there's not a real great sense of open-mindedness, I'll say, be it politics, be it religion. It's very hard to listen to somebody who doesn't share your exact same opinion, and I think that's quite sad.
Samantha Hunt is our guest on this week's book show. The new novel, Mr. Splitfoot, a novel, was published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. I'm hoping you can read a short section from the novel, and I'll let you set it up.
Sure, I'll be happy to. So this is where the two of the main characters, Ruth and Nat, are first meeting each other. They're quite young. They end up growing up together in a group home, in a foster care situation. And Ruth's sister, Elle, has just aged out of the system, and so Ruth believes she's alone. Ruth said nothing for 2 weeks. No one noticed. Eventually, the state brought the father a replacement, a boy named Nat, who'd had trouble with matches and kerosene. The Word became flesh and lived among them. The Word became flesh and lived among them. "You can be my sister now," Ruth told him. That was the Word. Nat was also 5, small enough to stuff inside the tall white garbage bag of clothes he carried. "All right," he agreed. "Sisters." Nat moved into the room Ruth had shared with Elle. Didn't even change the sheets. One twin bed. They slept foot to face. 2 heads on 1 body, joined like a knave card. Sisters. Ruth grew. Nat grew. The bed stayed small. Her hair got longer. His beauty sharpened like a vampire's. And while the father was distracted by meditations on his messiahhood, fantasizing his interview with Rolling Stone magazine and Oprah, some dewy bridge, a bundled corpus callosum, metastasized between the person of Nat and the person of Ruth. Their intimacy was obscene.
Samantha Hunt reading from the new novel, Mr. Splitfoot. In reading that, you get a sense of these characters, and there is a, just by the nature of their existence in this home, it lets them go into a road trip. This is that has a road trip aspect very yes. much to it.
Yes, yes. So these two characters are. Grow up in a group home situation that is not ideal. It's run by a fundamentalist Christian who is really completely hypocritical and preaches one thing and then acts another way and kind of shoves a lot of hatred down their throat. So they are trying to find a way out. They're trying to find a way to survive. They're about to age out of the system, and they know they're going to be 18 without much support. And they arrive at the idea to start charging people to talk to the dead. And so they channel the other children in the home's dead parents for them. They'll channel anybody. And the road trip comes in the second narrative, where Ruth, many years later, starts walking with her niece, Cora, across the state of New York. Ruth, in the second narrative, has stopped speaking. That idea of the voiceless woman for me came out of an obsession with the singer Linda Thompson, who, as her marriage with Richard Thompson was breaking up, she lost her voice. And I thought, wow, for a singer, this is how she makes her living. And she lost her voice, and she lost it for something like 11 years.
Right.
I had a great-grandmother who also lost her voice after her first child died and never spoke again. And so I've always been very interested in this idea of the voiceless woman. And I thought, wow, what a challenge in a book to try. How do I create a character who never can say anything? How is she going to make the narrative progress? How will I get her to function if she has no voice? And so that was a challenge, and also part of the delight of writing it was trying to pull it off.
And you do, because it's beautiful, because it's some of the most beautiful passages in the book, because it comes from feeling, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It was hard at first, but I ended up actually really loving those passages. And to some extent, silence is easier. And to some extent, silence is what we need, right? As I chitter-chatter away here.
Well, with the silence comes thought. It comes, we have time to percolate. We have time to think and work things through.
Exactly. And so during the silent section, Ruth is on a walk with her niece, who is pregnant and maybe in a bad situation. And what she really needs is time to think. She's in an environment, an office environment, where she's on the internet all day long and she's bombarded with information. And you can tell at the start of Cora's narrative that, you know, just too much information, and she's vibrating at such a heavy level and a high level, and there's no room for thought at all. And so to get out on the road where she has nothing, her cell phone breaks, I think, on the third day. And you know, she almost experiences it as a with heroin withdrawal, as, you know, I'm sure we're all too familiar with that feeling. Where's my phone? Where's my phone? Where's my phone? Right. And so a lot of it is kind of getting rid of the noise, her journey to figure out how she's going to be a mother to this child, to understand what mothering means as she comes. She's the daughter of Elle, the other sister who grew up in foster home without a mother. And so what does it mean to be a mother? You know, she's going to have to discover it for herself. And the only resource she has is this mute aunt to learn it about it.
And she has this urgency, this panic, but doesn't quite know why that is.
Yeah. Well, here her mute aunt has shown up and said, said without words, "You're coming with me. We're leaving now. Go." And Cora, for one reason or another, decides, yes, okay, I'm going to follow you. Let's go. We're heading out on the road. And so, you know, imagine that level of uncertainty. Where are we going? Where are we going? She asks again and again, even though she knows her aunt is not going to answer her. Her frustration is manifested again and again and again. Partly asking, why am I an idiot following you? Why am I doing this? Why can't I stop? She has a compulsion to follow her.
And there are these moments where they're marching in the mundane, but then it becomes untethered, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. So yeah, they're traveling through strip malls. You know, they're seeing a lot of men mowing their lawns. I think the man mowing his lawn shows up, you know, five or six times, as it would if you were actually crossing New York State.
Absolutely.
On foot, right? And this, even though the silence then also helps that mundane transform into something that might be a bit more human, open to compassion. And it lifts even further. So when they get to the Adirondacks and they are in these scenes of, you know, really the majesty of planet Earth, that Cora's ready for it in some way, and she's ready to deal with this silence. One of my favorite scenes, it happens in a forest that seems to be without end, as it would if you were walking with no compass, with no map, into a forest in the Adirondacks. And that idea came to me from another novel. It's a novel written for young adults called Catherwood, and it's set pre-Revolutionary War in upstate New York, and a young woman gets lost and she can't find her way home. And it's a very short little novel, but man, it affected me. Just that idea of walking in the woods and having really no idea where you are. And I don't know that kind of lost is possible anymore. And I was very interested in trying to create that sense of being so lost that you're actually not lost, because there's no possibility of found. You know, if you can navigate by the stars, maybe that would be your only hope for being found.
One of the things I feel I should bring up at this point is because we've been talking about this idea of religion and a journey and history and walking and figuring things out. This novel has great humor, though. It is very funny.
Thank you for saying so. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I am a happy person. I just have these questions I want answered. And quite frankly, I knew that these questions that I was dealing with could sound didactic or could sound heavy. You know, I'm talking about the hypocrisy of a country that doesn't take care of children, where there's this home of foster kids and nobody's taking care of them and they are in desperate need of help. And, it's heavy stuff. And I thought, wow, I can't do this without it being funny. There's no way, you know, there's no way anybody could stick with this kind of dark material if there weren't a laugh every now and then.
And the thing that I love, and this basically goes back to an earlier discussion that we were having, is that while you discuss these religions and you discuss these origin stories and you look in through this march through New York State, you do not present cynicism.
No. I mean, and honestly, that's how I feel. I feel like it's all a wonder. It's all amazing. I mean, maybe a good example of that is going when I was visiting Lilydale. I don't believe in people who talk to the dead. I don't believe they're really talking to the dead, but I love it. I think it's amazing that they do that. I think it's amazing that people believe it. And so being with some of these mediums when I was researching the book, it's dawned on me that even though I don't believe it, it still really affects me. And so that idea of the fact that even if I don't believe what you believe, your beliefs affect me. And that made it possible to not feel cynical about any of this, to genuinely feel like, okay, let me understand where you're coming from.
Do you think, if anything, the novel helps us become more open-minded?
I sincerely hope so. I sincerely hope so. You know, that it would initiate a sense of curiosity rather than fear in other people. I sincerely hope so. I mean, that's not to say there's not some real bad guys in this book. There are.
Sure.
There's some guys that I definitely want you to not like, right? As, you know, as I guess in life, right?
Absolutely. Do you, and this is going back to the character of Ruth, of having this voiceless woman, is there a power that you feel as a novelist in providing these voices and these thoughts?
For me, the process of writing is a process of teaching myself how to think about something. So yes, I feel a power for my own, you know, education. I teach myself about something through writing. I can't say that I actually think about my readers until way, way after it's done. And maybe that's not kind of me to not think of the reader, but I don't. So a sense of power, I don't know that that's necessarily what I feel. Although, yeah, sure, there is. There, it's hard not to make the leap here when I'm talking about building my own religion. You know, I am a power-hungry cult leader. Yeah, I kind of like that idea of thinking of the author as a leader of her own cult, right?
Well, early on when Nat and Ruth are, when they meet a con man, and I didn't really realize this until I read another book on the con, which is short for confidence.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which is something I never realized, yeah. Which is a power in and of itself of having that confidence.
Absolutely. And I, in this book, if I identify with anyone, it is with the con men in my book. And I kind of feel like there's a nobility in conning people. How is my job as a writer of fiction any different than a con man's job? I mean, I hope that I'm not duping people out of their money in quite the same way, but I'm trying to create a world that you will believe and that you will be affected by. You know, I'm conjuring a world in front of your eyes, I hope, if I'm doing my job right.
And if we accept it and we believe it, are we victims?
There's a question, right?
Yeah.
I'm a grateful victim of many authors' cons, if that's true. A real grateful victim.
The name of the novel is Mr. Splitfoot. It is just out. It is Samantha Hunt's third novel, and it's absolutely gorgeous and a real page turner, too.
Oh, thanks.
Samantha, what a great pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us. A real treat to have you on the program.
Thank you, Joe.
The name of the novel is Mr. Splitfoot. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.